So this morning I want to talk about responding to the fear of relapse. I want to talk about the pathway to relapse. How it is that in the face of a commitment to do or not do something, guys can find themselves heading down that path anyway. One of the things that's so hard about the process of addiction is there's no relationship between sincerity and sobriety. And often, people enter recovery in good faith, with absolute sincerity, and find that recovery can last years, months, or sometimes seconds, quite literally seconds. I have watched men make sincere commitments around not using, only to violate that commitment within seconds. Happening something along the lines of a man sitting in a bar, finishes a beer, and as he puts the glass down on the table, on the bar, he says, "That's it, I'm done, never again." And you can watch his face change as those words he just used echo around in his head, and they start to become real. And he starts to become overwhelmed by the possibility of facing the world without alcohol. And I've seen a guy in all sincerity say, "That's it, I quit, never again, starting tomorrow." Recovery for that man lasted seconds, that round. The standard, the thing people hope for, the thing that most of the people who love you guys are wanting when you arrive at MRTC, is that you'll be able to walk out of here at some point saying, "I will never use again." For most of the people who care about our clients, it's almost like the insanity of addiction is hard, but people stay with you, working, trying, fighting, helping, hoping. And then one day we get them into treatment. We finally got them into treatment. Please, don't send him back until he's fixed. With the hope that somehow, after 35 days, we will have done the treatment, and he'll stand up on this stage receiving his certificate that will certify that he will never use again. That's the hope. And many of the people who care about our clients feel confused and hurt and even betrayed by the recovery industry when they hear that we can't make those guarantees. That what the research tells us is that for any behavioral change in life, it often takes several rounds, several tries. When you look at people's attempts to quit smoking, on average, between 4 to 7, usually the magic number is around 7 sincere, sustained attempts to quit smoking before people manage any long-term cessation of tobacco use. It's the same with other drugs. I had to tell you, I love to swim, and I hate swimming in January. I love swimming in November. January is like swimming in rush hour traffic. Everybody with a New Year's resolution is in the lane in front of me, plodding along, gasping. And come November, I got the pool to myself. Because change is hard. And I want to talk about that today. I want to talk about the process of, not the process of change, not what gets guys to recovery, but the process of sustaining that change, the path to things going sideways. Guys will often walk out of MRTC with a commitment to not use again. And sometimes some guys manage to honor that commitment for a long time, forever. We got guys here in our alumni meeting today, 25 years ago, made that commitment. And they're still living the dream. And there are guys who don't make it home from the treatment center. And everything in between. What I want to talk about is some of the things, some of the process that sets guys up to end up in places that they don't want to be. Because for so many of our guys, they find themselves somewhere where they don't want to be. They find themselves making a choice that they didn't want to make. And they have this Homer Simpson, don't! You ask him, what happened? I don't know, man. It just happened. And yet when we really explore, when we really interview, when we really get into what's going on, we often find that we can trace back the genesis of most using experiences, most violations of a commitment to not use. We can trace it back seconds, minutes, often hours, days, months. And in the case of one guy I work with, we traced it back 4.5 years. We went through his history and he identified a decision that he made 4.5 years earlier that set him up to do something, 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 that put him on the skid, that put him on the slide, that put him in the bottle. A 4.5 year slide. Kind of reminds me of that scene in Austin Powers where the security guard is screaming because the steamroller is coming toward him. And then the camera angle switches to the side and the steamroller is doing 3 miles an hour. And it'll be about 3 minutes before it gets there. But the guy in the face is just that slow, painful slide. That's the good news, though. That time is your ally. That time is your best friend. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. Before I get there, everything in life comes with paperwork. This workshop is no exception. If I can get our guys to sign in with your first name, last initial, and room number, if you have a visitor with you today, their first name and relationship to you. If you're just visiting the center, your alumni, just your first name and the fact that you're visiting, just helps me keep track of who's here. So the first thing I really want to highlight is that the use of drugs or alcohol is and always is a choice. And you got to start from there. It's a choice. The use of drugs and alcohol is and always is a choice. And if there is any client in this building who does not believe that, you might as well pack and leave. Not because you're wrong or you're bad, but simply because we don't have anything for you. Our entire treatment program is built around the notion that the use of drugs and alcohol is a choice. Now, that being said, you have to appreciate that not all choices are equal. Would you like a piece of chocolate cake? Offers you a choice. You may say yes, you may say no. If you've just been rescued from a desert island where you haven't eaten in 14 days, what are the odds of you, in the face of an offer of chocolate cake, saying, no thank you, my cardiologist really wants me to cut down on trans fats? I don't think so. If I haven't eaten in 14 days, you better drop the cake or your hand's going to go with it. The choice that some people who don't have addiction, the choice they make around a beer or around a drug or around a substance really is, I could take it, I could leave it. For our men, the choice is something quite different. It's a much more difficult choice. It's a much more compulsive choice. And in the workshop next week, I'll talk something about that, about the way in which it seems to be different for men with addiction, that not all choices are equal. But the good news is there still is a choice. I have been here for a while, and I've worked with guys, and I've bumped into all kinds of situations. I guess we've had about 3,500 clients must have come through the center in the time I've been here. And I've heard it most. I have never, ever, in all the time I've been working, heard somebody say, I used in a way in which didn't leave me convinced that it wasn't their choice. And I got to tell you, if Buddy came to the front door and said, Wes, I got to tell you, I got drugs in my system, but it's not my fault. Well, what do you mean? What happened? Well, I was walking down the street, and this white van pulled up next to me, and these guys jumped out, and they threw me to the sidewalk and injected my drug of choice in my butt. Wasn't my fault. If somebody came and said that to me, my first question would be, how much extra did your dealer charge for that no-fault service? Yeah, can you in the van meet me at 11 o'clock? I'll be walking down low heat wearing the... It's always a choice. My favorite definition of addiction is just making the same damn bad choice over and over and over again, regardless of the consequences. It's not baffling or powerful or cunning, though. It follows a very predictive cycle. And it all seems to start when life's going pretty well. We bump into red flags. Red flags seem to be the entry point into the path to relapse. And red flags are thoughts, feelings, situations that start the process going. Triggers, if you will. What kind of things have been triggers for guys in this room? Old acquaintances. So certain friends. War stories. What kind of emotions? So being angry or being happy. Okay. Anybody ever get triggered by sunny days, beautiful weather? So sunny days can set guys off. Rainy days. I hear this all the time. Payday is a hard thing for guys. Guys ever get triggered by having money? Anybody ever get triggered by financial difficulties, not having money? Stress. Anybody get triggered by boredom? Anybody get triggered by excitement? So, I mean, we could go on and on and on about a list of possible things that trigger you, but so far we got a pretty good list. And I think if you just avoid these things, you'll probably be okay. So guys, just avoid connecting around friends or isolation. Avoid being angry or having negative feelings, or avoid being happy or having positive feelings. Avoid sunny days. Avoid rainy days. Avoid having money, but avoid having no money. Avoid stress or excitement, but avoid boredom. Avoid isolation, but avoid, you know, hanging around with too many people, you know, engaging in the party. So as long as you avoid everything, I think you'll be okay. Well, here's the thing. Pretty much anything can be a trigger. Pretty much anything can set you off. You want to know my favorite? My absolute favorite? Buddy walks through the front door. He goes, "Oh my God, Wes, I went sideways today. I need help. I thought I was going to be able to handle this, but I need help." "Dude, what happened?" He said, "It was on sale." Okay, I've heard it most. I'll never say I've heard it all. I've heard it most. "What do you mean it was on sale?" "It was on sale." So here's how this works. Guy heads over to the island for the weekend. He's coming back from the island. He's late in his program. He's 3-4 weeks in. He's got an overnight plans. Spends time with family. He's coming back, and he has to transit through downtown Vancouver. The bus from the ferry terminal drops him off, and he connects downtown Vancouver, and he walks onto a SkyTrain platform. And as he walks onto the SkyTrain platform, he goes running for the train. He can hear the train. He goes running for it. And he gets about this far from the train as the doors close, and the SkyTrain pulls away. About 10 o'clock at night on a Saturday night. And he goes, "Oh," and he realizes he's the only guy on this SkyTrain platform. And then he looks and he sees somebody about 50 feet away kind of stepping out of the shadow at the other end of the platform. And he realizes he's not alone on the SkyTrain platform. There's one other guy there. Only that guy wasn't running for the train. And he looks over at this guy, and the guy looks at him, and they exchange a look, and they know. They both know. And Buddy starts walking toward him, and he's thinking, "Oh, I don't need this. I don't need this. If you think you're going to try to sell me something, like..." So he's rehearsing two words. "No thanks." Or some variation of that. But rather than yelling from the other side of a SkyTrain platform, "No, thank you! I don't want to buy any dope! I'm in recovery!" He thinks that might make him look like a bit of a freak. Personally, I think that probably would be the way to do it. Instead of that, he decides he's going to play it a little cooler. He's going to wait. When Buddy gets about 10 feet away, he's going to do the "beat it." "Not interested." And so it's kind of like a gunfighter. He's rehearsing, and he's thinking about wrap-up tonight. He's going to come back to the house, and he's going to tell all the guys how he told Buddy to beat it. And he's thinking about how they're going to respond, and his head's going to these places, and Buddy's walking toward him. Feeling lucky, punk. And the guy gets like 10 feet and half a stride away from him. And he's just getting ready to say, beat it. And Buddy goes, I'll sell you 20 rock and a pipe for 15 bucks. On sale, yeah. And so all of a sudden he goes from like the words beat it or some variation on his lips to, huh? And in the moment he says, huh, the guy crosses that 10-foot barrier and walks closer. He's confused. And he looks at him. He has no intention of using it. He's just confused. He just looks at the guy and says, well, what do you mean? The guy walks right up to him. He says, got a 20 rock and a pipe. I'll save 15 bucks. Well, what's the catch? And he's not interested in buying dope. He's not interested in using. He's committed to his recovery. He's just now curious. What's the game? What's the game? What's the con? What's he trying to play me? What do you mean? What's the catch? Guy says, no catch. Here, see? And he drops his drug of choice and a pipe in his hand. And now our intrepid hero goes from this rehearsal of what he's going to tell the guys in wrap-up tonight, this plan, this being in a position of strength, to standing alone on a SkyTrain platform with a rock of his drug of choice and a pipe in his hand. And all of a sudden, all of that just vaporized in his head. And it did not help that he had about 19 bucks in his pocket. It was on sale. The very fact that it was on sale, the very fact that his consciousness shifted for a moment, that he got curious, that he allowed it into the zone, put him in a position where things went sideways on him. The reason I love this story, though, apart from the fact that it's kind of funny, is it's a story of strength. It's a story of amazing things. Well, that's the thing. I'm here telling you about it. What he did in the end was the amazing part. He found himself on a SkyTrain platform smoking, well, I don't know where he went to smoke, but he found himself doing crack cocaine. And before he finished it, he just thought about the house, and he thought of what he had planned to tell everybody, and now what he was going to tell everybody, and how that felt. And the feelings overwhelmed him, and he just got that to heck with it, or some variation thereof, kind of feeling. And he was just going to go and go hard. And then he thought, what am I doing? And he remembered everything he learned about the house, and he put it down. This is a guy, when I interviewed him, I said, when's the last time you had a relapse last about halfway through a discount 20 rock? He said, are you kidding, buddy? When I go out, it's see you next Tuesday. I said, so the fact you put it down, that's different? He said, absolutely. He put it down. Never done that before. And then he came back to the center, walked through the front door, walked up to the first staff member he could find. He says, help. I need some help. And we're saying, buddy, you keep doing stuff like this, the addicts are going to take your membership card away. That's not how a good addict does this. That's the amazing part of the story. Even in the face of it, his recovery was not going to be deterred. And I'm going to come back to the moral of that story. I'm going to come back to that. The thing I want to really impress upon you, though, is that these things all start with red flags, some kind of thought, feeling, situation that puts you in a hard headspace. But the red flag in and of itself is not an issue. The very fact that it was on sale, the very fact that he bumped into it at a SkyTrain station, that's actually quite disconnected from his decision to use. There were a lot of steps, and each one of those steps provided an escape route. That's what I want to talk about. But now I've got to prepare you for the most important moment in the 6 workshops that I do. This is probably the most important thing you'll ever hear me say. What I really want to impress upon you is the fact that pretty much everybody has things that trigger them. Pretty much everybody has these red flags. Pretty much everybody has vulnerabilities that can put them on the path to relapse. You probably know about most of them. How many guys in this building would think that you now have a pretty good handle on what your specific triggers are? Because not all of these are going to apply to all of you. How many guys in this room have a pretty good handle on what triggers you? Just one guy? Is that it? How many guys? So a little over half the guys in the room. of the guys in the room who have a pretty good handle on your triggers, how many of you have spent time with your important support people telling them about your triggers? Okay, we've just gone from about half the room to three hands. So there are a lot of guys in this room who have a good handle on their triggers, but only three of you have spent time talking to the important support people in your life about what they are. You seeing a disconnect there? Now here's the final question. Of the guys who have spent time talking to your important support people about what your triggers are, how many of you have talked to your support people about all of them? There's only one hand up. There's only one hand up. Because that's the temptation. That's the tendency. Guys come out of MRTC. They do all this work. I've discovered I have these 25 things that I got to watch out for. Because if any of these 25 things get in my way, I could end up getting loaded. And you know what? One of these days, I should get around to talking to the people who are my supports about what they are. Can you watch my back? Yeah, sure. How do I do that? Well, we'll talk about that later. And for the people who do talk, you know, honey, I got these 25 things we really got to watch. These 25 things I learned at MRTC that could put me on the path to using. So if you wouldn't mind watching it, if you see me doing any of these 23 things, you're going to need help. Because any of these 21 things that are going on in my life really put me at risk, and I wouldn't want any of these 19 things to blow where we are. So let's just make sure that we're always mindful of these 17 things. You know where I'm going with this, eh? The tendency to, I got these 25 things, but I'm going to put a few of them in my back pocket just in case. I'm committed to recovery. But just in case I need to get loaded, I got these 8 that I'll file away. And guys don't even realize they're doing that. Even if it's not your intention to do that, if you haven't put all 25 on the table, it's kind of like, you know what? If you walk out of a store with merchandise in your pocket, it's shoplifting, even if you intended to pay for it. You know, you have these 11 things you need to buy and it's too much to carry, so you put some in your pocket. Even if you're intending to put it on the counter on your way out, if you don't, it's a problem. The thing that's going to save you is not only your own mindfulness and your own vigilance to the path, it's the capacity to have other important support people in your life spot when things are going sideways and help you get off the path. Having those conversations with your important support people. If you want a recovery-related team to help you out, if you want them to watch you, you want them to call you, they got to know what to look for. And odds are pretty good. You got a handle on all kinds of stuff they haven't got a clue about. But the thing that never ceases to amaze guys is quite often the people who love them have all kinds of handles on all kinds of things they're not aware of. Having those conversations, absolutely critical if you're committed to recovery. Guys often don't, though, and one of the reasons they don't is because it can be damn inconvenient if the people in your life know all of your triggers, because it might get in the way of you using if you really want to. Red flags in and of themselves are not a problem. The problem with red flags is red flags lead you to craving. And by craving, I mean not only the physical, physiological kind of early recovery response, but I'm also talking about the stinking thinking, the distorted thinking, the thoughts that start to rationalize or justify or make using okay. When using or thoughts of using or the choice of using starts rattling around in your head, let's talk about that as craving. And that's potentially dangerous. It's not that getting a paycheck is a bad thing. It's that if you have a paycheck and all of a sudden what's rattling around in your head is, geez, I wonder if I could do just one. Now you're in a dangerous place. Craving can be really, really tricky. So I was working in this building and I just changed jobs. This would have been 4 years ago. And along with the new job came a new office, new desk. And so the counselor who was in that office, he moved out and I moved in. I was sharing an office with another one of the counselors here. I moved into this new office, moved into the new desk, and I took all the paper out of my old desk and I went to throw it in the bottom of the new desk, and I opened it up and three of the four drawers were empty. As I'm filling the office drawer, the desk drawers, I pull open the fourth drawer and three cigarettes are lying there. It had been, at that point, I guess almost 5 years since my last cigarette. Cigarettes just aren't even part of my consciousness. I pull open the desk drawer, three cigarettes are there. I don't even think about it. I just pick these three cigarettes up. And as soon as they hit my hand, a bolt of lightning went through me. And it was like, where did these come from? And then I knew. In a moment, I knew why the only thing in that desk were those three cigarettes. Those cigarettes were there because God was rewarding me for how well I was doing in my commitment to not smoke. He was saying, you know what, buddy, you're doing so well in your commitment to not smoke that these are on me. Enjoy. These are divine, will not hurt you cigarettes. As a matter of fact, I was doing so well in my commitment to not smoke that I got one from the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. They all got me one. And then the next thought that popped through my head, look at my watch, it's 10:30 in the morning. Next thought that pops through my head is I probably won't even smell like smoke when I get home tonight. And now all of a sudden, the thoughts rattling around in my head are around, somehow there's this divine intervention allowing me this free cigarette, consequence-free cigarette, and nobody will notice. All of a sudden, I'm now thinking about lying to my wife. She's a woman I love beyond anything. I wouldn't lie to her for anything. And yet, my head goes to this place of, shit, I won't even smell like smoke when I see her. And as I'm standing there, and everything's okay, I'm totally in control. The counselor I share an office with, Rob, he just looks up at me from his keyboard, and he goes, you all right? And in that moment, the reality of what's going on crashes down. As soon as Rob's saying, you all right, I realize that I'm in serious trouble. So, of course, I do the only thing that I can do in a time of serious trouble. I look back and I go, yeah, I'm fine. And he says, you sure? I said, yeah. He said, you need me to take those from you? I said, no. Why? He said, I don't know. Good luck. And it fortunately was enough to break me out of my trance that I went to the counselor who I used to share, who had that desk before me, and I said, you forgot these. I hope they kill you. I didn't say the last part. The guy was a beautiful man, and it makes for a beautiful story. 4 or 5 years after my last cigarette, completely out of my consciousness, all of a sudden, in a heartbeat, my head is going to, this would be okay. This would be, because this is different. It's like all that stinking thinking. And my experience had been every time it was different, it took me right back. Oh no, this would be okay because I'm not buying cigarettes, I'm just smoking one of my buddy's cigarettes. As long as I'm not buying, I'm not actually smoking, because like I can only smoke a couple because, you know, they're not my cigarettes. And then I smoke half a pack of his and he starts to get annoyed with me. So I buy him a pack of cigarettes. But I didn't smoke a pack of his cigarettes. I only smoked half a pack of his cigarettes. So I open that pack and I smoke half of them. But then I end up smoking too many, so I don't have enough to give him to pay him back. So I finish that pack and buy another one. And another 3 years of smoking go by until the last time in 2000 when I managed to get away from it. And then 5 years later, bang! The same stinking thinking right back there. Cravings, though, in and of themselves aren't an issue. So you're having these thoughts. So freaking what? They're thoughts. They're just thoughts. Thoughts aren't dangerous. Thoughts don't hurt you. What you choose to do about those thoughts, whether you let those thoughts drive your behavior, if those thoughts were to drive my feet out the back door, if those thoughts were to move my hand toward a lighter, the thing about craving is not that they're dangerous. The thing about craving is craving sends guys to obtaining. And obtaining often follows a set of rituals that guys may or may not be aware of. I remember working with a guy who had about 3 months clean. He was doing really well. And he was working at a job site one day, and he was expected to be there all day. He was getting paid to be there all day, and they managed to finish up by like 11 in the morning. He was done in 3 hours, getting a full day's pay, rest of the day off. Hops in his truck. He's got free time on his hands. And he decides, you know what, kind of hungry, I'm going to go get some lunch somewhere. I think I want a sticky bun. Sticky buns. I don't know if you're into sticky buns, a little gooey Chinese honey glazed pastry, golden, delicious, coconutty goodness. Yeah. How could a sticky bun ever hurt anybody? They're so loving and giving and harmless. And he decides he wants a sticky bun, but, you know, this is a guy who's got 3 months clean. He hasn't really treated himself much in 3 months, and now he wants a sticky bun. And why just get any sticky bun? I mean, he's out in, like, Port Moody. You can't get a good sticky bun in Port Moody. So he finds himself driving down Hastings toward Chinatown. Because if he's going to get a sticky bun, if he's going to reward himself with a sticky bun, he wants to go to the best bakery in town. And why not? He deserves it. So there he is, driving his truck down Hastings toward Chinatown with $400 in his pocket. So he's got lots of money to buy sticky buns. And the best bakery in Chinatown is half a block from where he used to buy crack cocaine. Where's he really going? His wife doesn't know he's not at work. He's got the entire afternoon off. Nobody knows. He doesn't have anywhere he has to be, anyone he's accountable to. Nobody's expecting him anywhere. He's got $400 in his pocket. He wants a sticky bun. And he finds himself driving across town. And he realizes, heading down to that bakery, heading down to that neighborhood, he's on autopilot. And then he kind of rewinds the tape a little bit. The red flag. Time off. Isolation, money, the craving, the sort of thought in his head, not a direct, I want crack cocaine craving. No, I just want to go down to my old war zone and attempt to buy just one sticky bun with $400 cash in my pocket. And odds are pretty good, I'm going to walk past all kinds of people that are going to be happy to see me. The ritual, the fact that he's going through the same route in the road again, he's heading to obtain. And he pulled out. He thought, what the hell am I doing? And he turned around and he pulled out and he went for some other type of food entirely and caught a lunchtime meeting. The ritual around obtaining the drug of choice is really powerful. And I can't underscore it enough. Another story about this guy here at the treatment center, a beautiful man, he was probably 4 weeks into treatment. And he was coming near the end of his treatment stay, and he decided to go home for the weekend and clean his apartment out. Because when he came into treatment, he got a phone call saying, we got a bed available. You know, he was due to come in 3 weeks later, and he got this phone call, we got a bed available. He said, I'll be right there. And he basically grabbed a clean pair of underwear and hopped a bus and came. Like, left his house in chaos. Whatever it was like when he left, he just left it. So the fridge was full of like rotten food, and the place was disgusting. And he thought, you know, I'm coming up on gratitude, I'm coming up on leaving, that's going to be very emotional, and I don't want to leave that and then come home and find myself just in this chaos. Smart plan. So he's going to go home and he's going to clean, and he's going to empty it out, and he's going to clean out the fridge, and he's going to make sure there's food there, and he's stocked, and he can come home from treatment when he's done, and his place will be ready to go. And his addiction was around, again, cocaine. And the thing for him was he really was addicted more to connection than to drugs. For him, his use of drugs was really around connecting. He would, an older guy, he would hit the nightclubs and attempt to connect with, you know, 20-something women in hopes of meeting some intimacy needs. And he would often mistake sexual intimacy for emotional intimacy. So he'd go out. He'd get cocaine. That would allow him to form these connections he was looking for. He'd get loaded, wouldn't have the connection he was looking for. The next morning would feel revolting, would feel shame, would feel guilt, would feel all kinds of things, which he, of course, would cope with by cheering himself up, by validating himself, And how he cheered himself up and validated himself, of course, was by getting the attraction of younger women. So he'd go back and get more coke and do it all again. This was his kind of pattern. And he learned a lot about that at the center. But he's down in his apartment. He's cleaning his apartment. He spends the entire day cleaning, and he's got it all looking the way he wants it. He's done a great job. He's emptied out the fridge. He's bought some groceries. Or no, he hadn't bought any groceries yet, but he's cleaned it out. And he decides he's just going to order a pizza, sit on his couch, and he gets to have the remote control all night. Because at the treatment center, trying to get your hands on the remote control is a really difficult thing, especially when you're more into watching A&E than, you know, Ultimate Fighting. And so he's looking forward to an evening at home, watching movies, having a pizza, kicking back on his own. But he feels pretty gross. He's been cleaning all day. He's been working all day. So he decides to have a shower. And he steps into the shower, and he showers up, and he comes out of the shower, and he gets dressed, and he shaves. And he pours some cologne in his hands, and he's just slapping some cologne on his face, and he's turning to walk out the door, when he stops. And he turns, and he looks back at himself in the mirror. And he realizes he's wearing his uniform of using. And he didn't even realize up until this point that he had a uniform of using. But again, the obtaining, the ruts in the road. He's going down the rut in the road. He looks at himself in the mirror, and there he's dressed in a pair of gray slacks and a dress shirt unbuttoned and gold chain. And he's just slapped on cologne. And he has to ask himself, if my plan is to stay home lying on the couch, eating pizza, watching TV, why am I dressed for the club? He went into the shower to get cleaned up because he'd been working all day. And he came out of the shower and just kind of on autopilot got himself dressed for the nightclub and was slapping cologne on his face and turning to walk out his bathroom door. And just outside his bathroom door was a little table where his keys and his cell phone were. And he could just feel himself moving toward them like on autopilot. Like this is just what comes next. And he stopped and he realized that he had a ritual. And as soon as he realized that he was playing through the same damn ritual he always played through to get his drug of choice, he thought, what did I miss? And he realized that he was craving, that running through his head were all sorts of thoughts about loneliness and all sorts of stinking thinking. It was kind of, the voices were there, but just under the level of awareness. And he thought, but why would I be craving? Why would I be bothered? Nothing's really triggered me. And then he realized he's just spent the entire day at home alone. And it's just underscored to him how at the treatment center he's connected, and then he comes home and he's alone. And that sense of being alone is the thing that had led him to getting loaded. And he played it back and realized that his red flag was being isolated in his apartment. And it led to all kinds of cravings and stinking thinking, which pushed him on the path to going to get loaded. He was walking out the door to get loaded before he realized that his feet were even heading there. And as soon as he caught on, I'm playing out the ritual, I'm doing the same thing I always do, he was able to recognize that he's very close to obtaining. And so he changed into a pair of sweatpants and a t-shirt, hopped a bus, came back to the center. Connected with the guys here, stayed clean and sober. Last I heard from him, he's still doing well today. Even if you go down the path to obtaining, though, even if you do successfully obtain your drug of choice, even when I'm standing here with the cigarette in my hand, the guy who found the Coke on sale has got the rock in his hand. If you go to a barbecue that's supposed to be a dry barbecue and somebody's brother-in-law, who no one was really expecting, shows up with a case of beer, even if he walks up and puts your favorite beer in your hand, even if you come home from treatment and your wife pulls open the fridge and says, honey, I really hope that recovery sticks this time, but in case it doesn't, I got your favorite beer stocked for you. I would hate you to have to relapse on warm beer. I mean, if you're going to relapse. You know, go into misery again, you might as well do it with a cold. You know, even in the face of that, where you're confronted with your substance of abuse, it ain't over. You got an open beer in your hand, a bottle on your lap, you still haven't used. You still have not used. Use is the next step on the road to relapse. And understand, from the moment the path to getting loaded starts until you find yourself actually ingesting a substance of abuse. You got a lot of steps. Sometimes, like in the case of the guy in the SkyTrain, it's a matter of seconds. Sometimes, like when I open the desk drawer, it's a matter of seconds between the red flag being confronted with it and the opportunity to use. But often, there are minutes or hours. I'm triggered and I've got time. The good news with that time, you bump into a red flag, so what? Before your head even goes to stinking thinking, get off the road to relapse. There's an off-ramp there. Hit a meeting. You're craving? Get off the road before you start heading down the path to obtaining. Even if you're standing there with your substance of abuse in your hand, the road doesn't have to go to using. You still have a choice. You still have an off-ramp. Now, the thing to appreciate to sort of extend this metaphor is that when you start here, you're starting from a standing start. By the time you hit here, you're doing 30. Pulling off an off-ramp at this point when you're doing 30, even if you're in the wrong lane, isn't really that difficult. By the time you hit here, you're doing about 90. Getting off that off-ramp, hitting the off-ramp at 90, a little trickier. By the time you hit here, you're doing about 120, 130. Trying to hit the off-ramp, it's a little dicey. Even if you miss the off-ramp and you end up here, you end up using. So many of our guys just think, it's over. It's over. I'm done. I've used. It's the greatest justification of all. Well, I've blown it now. I might as well get loaded. I've blown it now. I don't know what it is about human beings, but we have this incessant need to get our money's worth. I've blown it now. Let's see, I had 90 days sobriety, and then that jerk handed me a beer at a barbecue, and without really thinking about it, I just started pouring it back. And then I stopped and I looked at it, and I went, oh, I've just cashed in my 90 days. I just cashed my 90 days in on half a beer. And it's a light beer. I'm not cashing in 90 days on half a light beer. Oh, no. The price is the same whether it's half a light beer or whether I see you next Thursday. I'm not cashing in my recovery over half a light beer. If I'm going to do the time, if it's the same price, bring me a beer truck. I got some serious, serious relapsing to do. That's the problem. Guys will try to get off the road. They'll struggle. They'll do the best they can until they hit this point. And then there's something about the culture of recovery that so often sets guys up to experience this as, well, I've blown it now. Take your hands off the wheel. Continue to drive toward your destruction. The problem with finding yourself here is one of the big choice points is where that can take you is into this place of shame and guilt. And the reason that shame and guilt is so deadly is because shame and guilt is the biggest red flag of all. Shame and guilt is probably the most menacing trigger I'm aware of. When guys find themselves in this place of, I've blown it now, it's like, oh, I've let everybody down. I feel horrible. I feel this. I feel that. To heck with it. And the problem is, if you're doing 120 and you miss the off-ramp here and you end up using, by the time you hit shame and guilt, you're doing 150. Which means that red flag, you're coming through at 160. And now to try to get off at this point when you're doing 160, 180, 200, 220, 240. The problem with this cycle is when guys get on it, if you go around and you make it back up here, you're starting your second lap at a running start. And by the time you start your second lap at a running start, the odds of you being able to get off that off-ramp are really slim. Often what happens is guys do the first lap and then the second lap. And by the time you're on the third lap, you're going so fast, the only way you're going to get off that road is to hit the wall. Guys quite typically, if they go around that track, end up hitting the wall. It's like, I'm done, I'm active, and I'm going to find out what another bottom looks like. Now here's the good news. You don't have to go here. And even if you find yourself in that place of shame and guilt, like that guy standing on the SkyTrain platform, he finds himself feeling, oh God, I'm going to go into wrap-up and I'm going to face the guys and tell them that I let them all down and I've blown it all. What am I going to tell my family? And he just, And he just wants to go. He's here and he's heading for there. Even in the face of that, he finds another path out. And that path out is recovery and responsibility. When I talked to that guy, I said, when's the last time you did half a rock, put it down? Never. Well, does that sound like the actions of a man active in his addiction? Or does that sound like the actions of a man committed to recovery? When's the last time you violated a commitment and came running to a helping professional and said, you know what? I just have to confess that I did something I'm not supposed to. What kind of a self-respecting addict fails to scheme and scam? It's like, buddy, if you want to be an addict, you're doing it all wrong. The addicts, they're all scheming and scamming and trying to come over the fence at 3 in the morning. This walking up to a helping professional, that's going to keep you clean and sober. If the addicts catch you talking to me, they're going to take your membership card away. Because that's a sign of a man in recovery. The good news, if you buy into this, you hit a red flag, you pull off into recovery. You find yourself craving, you pull off into recovery. You find yourself obtaining, you bump into it. You walk in on your roommate, you pull off into recovery. You make a bad choice. Well, you can either go to shame and guilt, or you can say, you know what? I made a bad choice. I made a choice I don't want to make. See, one of the things that guys have to contend with, one of the reasons why guys come through intensive residential treatment and then continue to struggle, is when you leave here, you know lots of stuff. You know lots of triggers. You know lots of things. But you don't know what you don't know until you know you don't know. You know? Buddy on the SkyTrain platform did not know he didn't know how to handle discount cocaine. And then he knew he didn't know, but it was too late. Now he knows. I'm busy. You don't know what you don't know. You're going to bump into stuff. Some of the stuff is going to knock you a little bit sideways. Maybe some of that stuff is going to knock you a lot sideways. But so freaking what? You end up using. So freaking what? This is not permission to use. And this is the part of the workshop that really makes me afraid, because I've ended up going upstairs to find guys drunk in their room after this workshop going, Wes, I love you, man. I've been to a lot of treatment places, but I've never had a counselor tell me it's okay to have a few beer. That's why we say the Serenity Prayer so often. I am not saying, you know what, it's okay to use, just take responsibility. It's not. It's kind of like, it's not okay to cheat on your wife, as long as you come home and say, honey, I just slept with a neighbor again. I mean, but I guess what we really need to do is recognize that recovery is about integrity. And for me, anyway, my integrity has nothing to do with whether or not I make a mistake. Because I'm going to make mistakes. I'm going to end up failing to honor commitments. Sometimes knowingly, sometimes not knowing. Sometimes there'll be honest mistakes. Sometimes maybe I'll just find myself thinking in ways that don't really honor the way I want to think. But there will be times when I make mistakes. I mean, I can't for a moment stand up here and be self-righteous enough to tell you guys that I will never make a mistake again for as long as I live. I mean, it would be nice for me to make it to lunch without making a mistake. But integrity for me has nothing to do with whether or not I make a mistake. Integrity for me has nothing to do with whether or not I fail to honor a commitment I have to somebody. Integrity, to me, has everything to do with what I'm willing to do immediately after failing to honor a commitment. Recovery is not best measured where you are here. Recovery. You want to know how your recovery's doing? You want to know what your integrity looks like? You find yourself having to make this decision. Which fork? You find yourself making this decision, you'll find out a lot about your integrity. You'll find out a lot about your recovery. But again, one of the hard edges. There are many treatment facilities that think that MRTC encourages using because of this position. Oh, MRTC, they tell you it's okay to use. Quite the opposite. What we tell you at MRTC is if you find yourself going sideways, get back up. Which is an awful lot like what this guy is. This guy once upon a time by the name of Bill W. who used to say, you know what? We really hope recovery takes you places. If, however, you find yourself going sideways, just get back up. I got a chair right here waiting for you. The only requirement is that you're clean and sober and sincere and in your desire to remain that way today. Just no matter what happens, no matter how many times you fall, get back up. The guys who are successful ultimately in recovery, it's actually a really simple formula. The guys who ultimately get this right are the guys who have one more recovery than relapse. It sounds kind of stupid. It's kind of like I heard a hockey player going into the third period of a game where the score was 2-2 saying to the commentator about the plan for the third period, he said, well, you know, I'm just thinking if we put our puck in their net a little more often than they put it in ours, I really like our chances of winning the game. No, he liked the chances of winning. And I'm thinking, buddy, do you practice without a helmet? Like, if we score more than them, I think we might win. But really, as simple, as silly as that sounds, if you go here one more time than you go here, you're good. That simple. You're done. Recovery and responsibility. The final piece is the role of important support people in your lives. If you look at this as the road to relapse, many of the people who care about you have watched you getting on the road to relapse. And many of the people who care about you have done their darndest to stop you when you're going down the road to relapse. Unfortunately, they don't always know how to stop you. And many of them try to stop you as they see you running down the road to relapse. They run out in the middle of the road and they go, stop! Which for many of the family members I work with, many of the people who love you I work with, it explains why they end up feeling like hood ornaments on the road to relapse. You jump out in front of a moving vehicle and yell, stop. Sometimes buddy's not paying attention. Sometimes buddy doesn't want to stop. Sometimes buddy desperately wants to stop. He just can't. He's going too fast. Even if he stepped on the brakes, even if he tried to swerve, you jump out in front of him. There's no way he can stop. You're going to get run over. And the people who care about our clients, they get run over a lot. So how do you help? How do you support? How do you invite people into supporting you without having to run them over? Because I got to tell you, if you hit this point and you have three relatives on your grill, the intensity of the experience here is going to be so much more. Well, the best way to help is stay off the freaking road. Back before radios, NASCAR had a system. It was a beautiful system. The race is going on. The pit chief is on the sidelines with the stopwatch. And I'm seeing that, you know what? Your lap times are down a second and a half. You're obviously getting loose in the corners. You don't have the kind of traction you did. Your tires need replacing. You're just not as fast as you were. From inside the car, can you really tell the difference between a lap that takes a minute 29 versus a lap that takes a minute 30? Probably not. You probably don't know that you're starting to get loose. You probably don't know that you're getting slow, but the stopwatch, I'm standing on the side, and I'm saying, you know what? You're starting to slip. You're starting to lose traction. We didn't send some schmuck from the pit crew, hey, go run out in the middle of the track and go, Bob, stop! What we did is we quite simply had him standing on the side of the track holding up a sign. Number 28. Buddy drives by, he sees the sign with his number being held up, and he goes, I guess somebody's telling me I need to pull over. I guess somebody's telling me I need to have my car checked. I guess somebody's telling me that I'm not running as effectively as I could be. Somebody's telling me if I don't pull into the pits now, five laps from now, I could lose traction, hit the wall, and end up in a very, very bad place. I need to pull over. And nobody has to get hurt. That's the key. The trick, if you love somebody with an addiction, is to stand on the sidelines, on the side of that road, holding up the sign. I just want to let you know that you're slipping. Now, people then say to me, well, Wes, what should be on those signs? What do I write? How do I get my client's attention? I don't know. I really don't. If I did, I'd be rich. But I don't. So I'm not. But that's okay. Because our guys know. Everybody in this room has something worth cleaning up for. Everybody in this room has something more important than their substance of abuse. You know, I'll tell a story of, you know, if a guy's driving, he's got his kid in the back seat, he's looks in the rear view, realizes his kid's in the back seat eating, starts to choke. Airway's closed off. 2 blocks from a hospital. But he realizes, my God, my child, airway completely blocked. Well, I can stop and try to deal with that, or I can actually practically see the hospital from here. Like divine intervention that had happened here. I'm 90 seconds away. I'm not even going to try to stop. I'm just going to book it to the hospital. Buddy points the car toward the hospital, floors it. Halfway there, big pile of a substance of abuse on the sidewalk with a sign on the top that says free. When faced with the impending demise of someone he loves, I have yet to work with a client who says, no, if my kid was about to die, I'd stop. Every guy I've ever worked with has said, if my kid was about to die, that is so important to me, I'd keep going. I would make it to the emergency room. I'd come screaming up to the doors. I'd pull my kid out. I'd run to the nurse. I'd knock people out of the way. I'd say, help. My child is choking. Help. Of course, most of the guys I work with, as soon as the nurse took the kid, would say, excuse me, I've got to go park the car. But my point is that for every man in recovery, for every man who makes an attempt at this, there is something important enough to make the attempt for. I want to be a father to my son. I want to be a man of integrity. I don't want to make my wife a widow. Whatever it happens to be, whatever the reason is, men have reasons. Reasons that are important enough to clean up for. And I can't for a moment begin to tell you what to put on a sign, what to tell somebody you care about. But if they can make a sign for you to hold, if they can make a sign that says, how will this decision impact your ability to spend quality time with your son this weekend? How will this decision honor the man of integrity you're striving to be? When you go to bed tonight, will you feel at peace knowing you've made this choice? I don't need to know that. You asked me to remind you to ask yourself that. You stand on the side of the road and you hold up that sign with whatever is important to them on it, and they're either going to get it or they're not. But that's all you can do. That's everything you can do. The rest is up to them. The choice is theirs. Nothing you can say or do can make them use or stop them from using. All you can do is stand on the sidelines at every off-ramp and hold up the information. If you see it, you don't even have to fight with them about it. I see you losing traction. No, I'm not. I'm all good. Hey, hang on. I don't want to debate this with you. You asked me to hold up the sign if I'm seeing this, and I'm holding up the sign because I'm seeing this. You telling me I'm wrong? I hope so. End of story. I've done everything I can. The other thing, notice I'm drawing more than one person at every off-ramp. I hear this all the time. Yeah, I got support. I got a sponsor. You know what? Sponsors relapse. Wives sometimes leave you. Friends sometimes let you down. Counselors sometimes take vacations in Hawaii. People that you're counting on sometimes aren't there. If your recovery relies on the one person in your life who knows you, well, as long as that one person is ready, willing, and able to be there when you need them, I think you're okay. But for most of us, we need a recovery-related team. Most NASCAR pit crews aren't one guy. It's an entire team of people. As a matter of fact, the research suggests the more people you got on your side who understand you, the more people you got on your side who know your risk factors, the more people you got on your side who have a direct connection to the kinds of things that work for you or against you, the better your odds of maintaining sobriety in the long term. The road to relapse. It's something that probably most everyone in this room is going to find or has found that they've been on. But even if you find yourself on it, you got choices. And if you love somebody, you don't need to take responsibility for their choices. And you certainly don't need to be stepping in front of them when they're on their way to wherever. I'm just wanting to let you know that I'm seeing the following things. While you're just, well, hang on a sec, I'm not willing to take any abuse. I'm not willing to fight with you over this. I'm just doing what you asked me to do. If you don't require my services anymore, so be it. Good luck. But I'm not getting run over. The time to set this up is right now. Earlier in this workshop, when I asked how many people in this room had told the important support people in their lives about all of their triggers, all of the cravings, all of the rituals, we had one hand. That needs to change. That really needs to change. Because you will find yourself confronted. You will find yourself in a situation that you don't know how to handle. And I can't teach you how to handle that situation because I don't know what you don't know. I certainly didn't know that we needed to teach guys how to say no to discount cocaine. I don't know of any treatment center that offers a workshop on how to say no to sales. Just, we didn't know it was an issue. Even if you find yourself in a place you don't want to be, even if you find yourself making a choice you don't want to make, it ain't over. You still have choices. You still, even in that moment, have choices. And it's not pleasant, it's not easy, but the alternative is another lap. The alternative is hitting the wall. By no means do I sanction, you know what, it's all okay, do what you're going to do, just as long as you say sorry later. That's not it. Work your program. Bring people in. Get them fully versed on helping you. Give them what you need to hear in dark moments. Take responsibility. And if you find yourself on the path, I really hope you make the right choice. But even if you don't, I really hope you make the right choice. Next week, I'm going to talk about the basics of addiction. I'm going to talk about what addiction is, why it's more than just willpower. I'm going to come at it from a couple of different perspectives. Hope to see you again then. Thanks.